Hello, friends, and welcome back to the show. Before we dive into the conversation, I want to take a moment to tell you all about Shady Rays. Before I say anything else, let me say this. What I'm about to lay out is not a paid ad. For the longest time, I kept seeing these ads on social media for these sunglasses, polarized, just the right fit, and they looked cool as hell. Well, then I checked out their website and I ordered two pairs. I have got to tell you, these are the best sunglasses I've ever owned. Shady Rays is an independent sunglass company that focuses on one thing, making the best shades for living active and worry-free in the outdoors. These shades feature shatter-resistant, high-visibility, polarized lenses, and durable construction. And the Shady Rays team stands behind them with free replacements if you lose or break them and a lifetime craftsmanship warranty. I can testify to this. If you break a pair of glasses or you simply lose them like I do, just reach out. All you have to do is pay for shipping. They send you another pair. Unbelievable. And here's what's really cool, friends. They didn't want to settle for being a company that just sells sunglasses. They wanted to make a difference with each purchase. Through research and talking directly to their fans, the Shady Rays team found the cause that gives purpose to their work. In partnership with Feeding America, Shady Rays donates 10 meals to fight hunger in America with every single order. One pair of sunglasses equals 10 meals. Thanks to their loyal customers, Shady Rays has provided over 9.4 million meals, and they continue to donate thousands of meals every day through Feeding America-sponsored food banks across the country. Folks, everyone needs a good pair of sunglasses. Stop paying hundreds for them and go to this website right now. Go to ShadyRays.com and check out their fantastic sunglasses. I promise you, you won't be disappointed. ShadyRays.com, make that purchase, give your eyes a much-needed break this summer, and help Feed America 10 meals at a time.
You see here, kid, you gotta just go for it. Don't think about what comes after or what came before.
And welcome back to the show, the one and only Susanna Harris. Thanks for hanging out with me tonight. I really appreciate this.
Hey, Chris. It's my pleasure. It's pretty cool how we can actually connect still through the internet and things like that.
Absolutely, 100%. It's funny. The first time I saw and heard you was a talk that we'll, of course, link to in the show notes tonight. But it's for the Monty video series, The Man Behind the Curtain. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to spoil that talk here because I was so blown away by it, and I think it's such a powerful piece that I want people to sort of consume it in its entirety. But that was a really, really powerful piece, and I knew as soon as I watched that I had to reach out to you. And so thank you for being so raw with that, because I really believe that changed people's lives hearing that, and I think it will for future generations too that hear that.
Mm. Well, thank you so much. Yeah, it was. I think I recorded that right around 2 years ago, almost exactly 2 years ago, and. Yeah, it still really means a lot to hear that from folks. And I do hope people listen to it. I will say there is a happy ending. It does get a little bit dark, but as you'll see.
Yes, absolutely. And yeah, please, as accompanying this interview tonight, definitely check that out and watch it after the interview, or even before if you want to pause right now and watch it and then come back to this.
Yeah, definitely come back though.
Yes, definitely come back, because it's gonna get good. Now, before we dive into the topics we're going to cover tonight, let's do a little housekeeping, get that out of the way up front. Can you tell me a little bit about your education, your professional background thus far?
Sure. So I got my undergraduate degree in microbiology and immunology at the University of Iowa, and that was in Iowa City. I actually grew up in kind of a smaller town in Iowa and moved to North Carolina, Chapel Hill, for grad school back in, wow, that was 2014. I just now graduated with my PhD in microbiology, I guess about 2 months ago. So yeah, I've got the PhD. Thank you. It was a long process, but I'm glad that I got through it, and it's at that point. And so now I work, I do two kind of different things, but I guess they overlap. One is I work as the lead of marketing for a company here that writes grants for biotech life science companies. Mm. So companies can actually apply for federal grants, and the company I work for, Grant Engine, they actually write and make these grants. And so I get to talk with scientists. I get to talk with researchers, with business people, really enjoy that kind of science communication side. And then I also continue to run my business PhD balance.
You know, and just kind of like looking at some of your stuff on Twitter and everything, I always ask this question every time I have someone that's in a specific career on the show, But was there a specific attraction to science throughout grade school? Something that, that made you switch, that made a switch flip in your brain or anything like that and tell you, this is what I want to do? Like, did it go all the way back to when you were a kid?
Oh, absolutely. I think the biggest turning point was really when I figured out what part of science I wanted to focus on. I mean, growing up, I loved two things, which were reading and science. Truly, my parents had to limit the number of hours a day I was allowed to read at some points. But loved science, really kind of figured out early on I didn't want to be a doctor. I wasn't really that interested in humans. Kind of did that thing where I thought about being a veterinarian or maybe I'd work at an aquarium or something like that. And I really didn't have much of an idea about that I could be a scientist. I didn't consider that as a career option until I got into high school. It was my second to last year. So my junior year of high school, I took an AP bio class. So like a class that you take instead of having to take a college class. And we learned about bacteria and viruses for, I think, a day and a half or something. And I was just enamored. I was like, this is the coolest thing I've ever heard. They're everywhere. They're all over me. I'm touching them. And apparently they just sort of like run our lives in the background. This is the kind of tide pool that I would like to play in.
Yeah, boy. And if that's not relevant now, I don't know when it would ever be. So that's pretty incredible. There's so many scientific fields that one could choose to make a career out of. So why microbiology specifically? I mean, what was it about that? Is it just the fascination with kind of what you just alluded to? What was it specifically that made you think, okay, this is it for me?
So for me, at least, it's this combination of unknown, but I can still play with it. Yeah. I liked to do things. I brought up the kind of like the tide pool analogy because that was something I did as a little kid. When we'd go to California or something. Growing up in Iowa, you're not near any beach unless you count lakes. And that's a different discussion. But going to the tide pools and just saying, I wonder what's in here and being able to flip things over. I was much more interested in this idea of exploration. What could I find? I never got into when, you know, people are like classifying different trees and being able to see them by sight and knowing their really fancy names. That's awesome. I think it's super cool. Not my thing. Then also, like, I want to be able to do the exploration piece. But the other thing is, it's really important for me to be hands-on. I really enjoy, you know, not necessarily when people think hands-on, they think of like Play-Doh, but hands-on can mean, you know, you're running your own experiments in terms of, okay, you can manipulate things. So versus just, I'm going to sit here and let's say like watch which birds come by and I'll make a hypothesis of, I bet that a sparrow will come by in the next 2 hours and it does or it doesn't. It's still science. It's still, you know, making these hypotheses, testing them, looking for other information. But in this analogy, what I would prefer to do is say, okay, if I release 10 sparrows, how many of them will come back in 2 hours? So a little bit more of like where I can control things. That really lends itself well to biology and specifically microbiology. I realized that that was somewhere that I could kind of play in these tide pools anywhere. I could study human diseases. I could, you know, I was really interested in the idea of neglected tropical diseases, which are diseases that are mostly experienced in developing countries that don't necessarily get a lot of attention because of funding purposes. I could go to the ocean and see what's on the surface all the way into the deep sea vents. It's just this amazing world that everywhere I could learn something.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. I mean, I guess I wonder the natural question is, what has it been like for you ever since, you know, we've had the introduction of COVID-19 and everything that's been going around in the world? We won't go too much into that. But I mean, what has it been like for you? How has it changed you? What's the fallout, I guess, for lack of a better term, for what we're dealing with right now?
It's kind of interesting because as we're talking, I've been out of the lab for 3, maybe 4 months, partially because of COVID. It shut down my lab, which it should have. Like, we should all be taking this very seriously and not be going in just because we want to be doing something or we feel pressure to make progress in a time where it's really impossible.
Yeah.
COVID is this microbial situation. It's a virus. It's something that I've studied its relatives, and taking classes on virology. And so I at least understand more than the general population. But it's been really, it's really interesting because at the start of this, everyone was turning to me and asking questions. Everyone was saying, can I understand this? Like, where, what are we doing? How can this spread? I want to know all the details. I want to know what to be reading. And slowly it just turned into kind of an annoyance factor. People are not interested in it anymore. It's much more, how do we fight this? Which is totally understandable. Mm-hmm. But I think as a microbiologist, it's interesting because my interest in the pathogen itself, in the virus, hasn't changed. I think it's a really interesting virus that we don't understand the disease. We don't understand so much about this. And so it's been an interesting reminder for me, at least, that like, these skills that I've built in grad school of learning things and dissecting them and being able to read these specific papers is actually something that serves me that maybe other people don't have or don't even really have the desire to do those things.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting for me. It's because I talk to a lot of scientists on the show, and I have a lot of friends who are in that field or in those fields, and they all say the same thing. They all echo the same thing as far as, you know, this is something that should be taken very seriously. And then, you know, it's frustrating to me to watch the news and you see all these people that are just, you know, not adhering to what a lot of these people are saying that study this, that live in this environment, that deal with this all the time. Mm-hmm. And it's got to be really frustrating. I mean, I imagine for you, it would be frustrating. I mean, imagine for people that are in your field, your friends that are doing the same thing, that would be frustrating, I imagine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess it's especially difficult when you talk to people who have very clearly said, I'm really proud of you for getting a PhD in microbiology, or I'm really impressed by, you know, your science communication efforts. And then you point out like, hey, this behavior or whatever is putting you at risk and it's making me nervous. And for them to turn around and say, you know, I can see the news. Thank you. Like I understand there are different viewpoints. And I'm like, well, there's different viewpoints on literally everything. I don't know. I mean, one of the things that Twitter has taught me is you can't say something that everyone agrees with.
Yes. True.
And so to say that there's differing viewpoints on something doesn't mean that one is correct and one isn't, right? It doesn't mean that all of these have equal validity.
Yes, very, very much true. Very much yes. So I guess what I want to ask you, because you touched on science communication a couple times, and I think that's really important. I was just talking to a friend of mine. Her name's Jill Myers, and she does a lot of a lot of that. She does a lot of mentoring. She's, you know, we had a really, really great conversation about sort of, you know, children sort of coming up now in this age and wanting to be scientists, and kind of where do they look and where do they turn? What examples can they see? Sally Ride once had a very famous quote that you can't be what you can't see. And that's something that was really powerful to me always, even as a kid. And I want to talk to you about science communication and kind of what you do in that kind of area, because I think that's really important. Can you tell everybody sort of what you do, what your role is?
So I got into science communication, I guess actively, other than just, you know, everyone talks about their science with their friends or things like that, but this idea of science communication being experts talking to non-experts, or experts can talk to each other, but generally when we think of science communication, it's someone with expertise or who's currently working in a certain field talking to someone who isn't. And that can be just general people, that can be policymakers, that can be children. And so I got into this field, I think in the third year of my PhD, the start of the third year, I started volunteering at the local Moorhead and Planetarium. It's like a Moorhead Planetarium and Science Center, rather. They do this really cool program. It was called the Impacts Program, where they would take scientists and they would have us go through this entire training process. And we would learn how to take our current research and turn it into really activities that could be used in classrooms or at kind of science fairs. And we had to think critically about how to communicate some of our enthusiasm and also some of our science. And it was a really challenging experience for me. But I enjoyed this. I enjoyed going to the classrooms and talking to kids. And especially since most of the classrooms were in rural North Carolina. And for a lot of them, most of them had never met a scientist. It was fun because there was one class that it was in a middle school building, and I think it was like the second period of the day or something, and I was already up at the front and kind of just hanging out, and some kids came in to start the class and they go, "Oh, this sucks. I thought we were gonna have a scientist. Why do we have a sub?"
Oh man.
So that was awesome. I really enjoyed it. And then actually the next year I got the opportunity to train other scientists, so I became a trainer in that same program, and that's really where I found my favorite spot, which is working between experts and whoever else they're trying to communicate with, because communicating itself is a skill, and it's not something that I think we should expect everyone to have. There's pieces in my research projects that I didn't do because I'm not an expert in X, right? I don't enjoy doing Western blots, looking at protein production from cells and things like that. So if I ever have to do something like that for my science, I've worked with somebody else who's better at it. And in terms of how other scientists can get involved with science communication, I think it's really important to realize that it can be very useful to talk with someone who is an expert in these pieces. That training program allowed me to understand the importance of listening to other people when you're trying to communicate. And from it, most of my science communication now, luckily even before the pandemic, had transitioned over to doing a lot of social media discussion. I do some freelance writing. I've hosted workshops and things specifically looking at how to transition your science research into communication versus even workshops about how to create a science communication based website, not website necessarily, but social media platform, how to effectively do those things. So it's, I guess it's, I don't know, I'm giving you such a super long rambly answer.
No, that's good. It's important.
I think it's interesting because I've never seen it as my job, but now in a lot of ways I'm getting paid for it. So it was always something that when I wasn't enjoying my PhD so much and I needed motivation to keep going, I would do science communication and remember how cool science actually was. And so it's very strange for me now to be like, yeah, I do this science communication, and also it pays my bills. So it's a really good thing.
Yeah, no, I agree. And it's interesting listening to you tell that story about, you know, teaching children and going into the class and them saying, oh, you know, it's a sub, it's not a scientist. I there's like a running joke, and it's not really a joke, but it's, yeah, my partner for Vanished, which is a show that we do. She's a criminal defense attorney out of Austin. And it's funny, she's told me this so many times. She goes, every time I'm in the courtroom, they always assume I'm the paralegal. Like I'm not the actual lawyer. Like I've had so many men come up to me and be like, oh, it's, you know, where's the lawyer? And it's like, I'm standing right here. And they always think that. And it's like, it's really, you know, that's really unfortunate. And I've talked to so many women in STEM. We did a whole project on Amelia Earhart, who was, I think, unbeknownst to her, way ahead of her time, and was a pioneer in STEM, and was like, you know, in Purdue telling women, hey, no, you don't need to be a housewife. You can be a scientist. You can be a mathematician. You can fly. You know, there's all kinds of different things. But, you know, is there a, I think I know the answer to this question, but I love to hear POVs from everybody I have on the show. Is there a stigma there? Is there an issue with women in STEM? And if there is, what can we do to get more young women involved? Do they need to turn around and see women like you doing what they want to do? They need to see those examples. Like, what do we do? What's the answer there?
I think there is a huge part of representation. And I think, you know, definitely being a woman in STEM is difficult. I think a lot of the numbers we look at are from a while back. And it also depends, I think it's really important to realize that it depends on your audience, right? That a group of folks who are in rural North Carolina have never met any scientist. All of their impressions of a scientist are going to be either something they've seen on television, or if they think of medicine, they'll think of their primary care doctor, right?
Right.
And so they have a very different view of scientists and medical professionals versus somebody who lives where I do, which is in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, which is an extremely kind of like urban, highly educated population, especially towards medicine and technology. And so when I would do outreach stuff here at the local library, I mean, a lot of the kids had parents who were scientists or doctors. But I think what's really important is to look at the actual representation in the fields, right? That in biological sciences, like 50% of the people are women in across different fields. And there are a lot of issues as far as where they are in at different levels. So there's a lot more trainees who are women. There's a lot more advisors or professors, especially full professors, who are men. And that's something that we still need to be working towards. Certainly, there's been a huge push for, when you think of a scientist, who do you think of? And you know, oh yeah. No, it's this old white man. But now we're really realizing this issue of, oh no, it's just a white person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you see a lot of those pushes to help kids think about scientists. And I've either seen it done of, it's not this old white man, or I've seen it done where they say you as well could be a scientist, which is great. And I think that's what we should be telling kids, but we should also be showing them. And it's actually not that hard to go online and find a science show that is produced or stars a woman. Like there's,
yeah.
White women science communicators like myself are a dime a dozen. There's a ton of us. Mm. If you can't find one of us, I don't know where you're looking. and that's not to say we don't face really nasty stuff on the internet. Like some of the messages that I get either publicly or privately into my direct messages are just disgusting. Mm. But there's a difference, I think. And at least, you know, to try to look at and say, I think one of our issues, we say, well, we don't want to have just white people. So we'll have it be half white people and half everyone else.
Yeah.
And to realize, you know, that's not actually a representative target population. It's not enough to have a white man, a white woman, a black man, and an Asian woman, and to call that equal, because that it just doesn't represent populations. You're missing a ton of other diversity. And I think that's where social media can be really beautiful, is that you can go and find people who are up and coming science communicators and scientists and medical professionals of all different intersecting backgrounds. And so I think my hope is that I will be part of the last generation that really thinks about women in STEM. It's something we need to keep in mind, but I hope that my generation is one that can say, okay, we're not done there, but we need to keep that more on the back burner. That needs to keep warm. We need to keep stirring that, but we really need to be focusing on these other intersectional identities.
Yeah, 100% agreed. You know, and one of the ways I think what you do is really great is, and I watched several of these over the last weekend, but you have a great YouTube series called Ask Me, I'm a Scientist. And I think, again, we'll link to that in the show notes tonight, but it's, talk about like kind of how that came about. I mean, was that just sort of another way for you to sort of reach out and just talk to other, I mean, you touched on sort of like talking to other folks who are just in different fields that you maybe have more expertise in a specific area than you do. Introducing those folks, you know, to the masses. I mean, talk about that process.
It's funny to me because everyone always assumes like really great intentions from me. And I always have to be the bearer of bad news of it was. So it all started right when the COVID pandemic was really taking off. It was early March, I think, is when I started thinking about this series. But it was because my partner, he was going to be going to California to see friends. And I was really panicking because I was looking at the stats. I was saying, I really don't feel comfortable. And so I started digging into the literature and trying to figure out what exactly was happening. And I wasn't satisfied with what I could find, even though I could get behind paywalls. You know, I could find every publication. So I started reaching out directly to the experts. And the conversations with them made me feel a lot more comfortable. And so that's where I started thinking, oh, well, if I'm enjoying this, maybe other people would too. And if I can ask these questions easily, like it would be nice if other people who don't have as large of a platform as I do, if they got at least an opportunity to ask a question of somebody who was an expert in that field.
Yeah.
And kept going because I was just really enjoying it. I mean, people seem to be enjoying it, but it is a side project that I don't get paid for, and I wanted to really enjoy it. And so I started talking to different experts, and it's, I have just the best time. I get to talk with the most amazing people, and I get to learn different pieces of science all the time. I've learned about like elephants. I've learned about how people study empathy. I've learned about MRIs and AI and so many different pieces. And it's like, I get my own little personalized science lecture. But yeah, everyone's like, oh, that's so nice of you. I'm like, sure. Yeah, totally.
Right. Yeah. Well, it does help a lot. I think it's really great. It gives you like a great snapshot of, you know, of something specific you want to listen to or you want to learn about. So yeah, it is really great. And I guess one of the last things I wanted to talk to you about tonight was PhD balance, because I know that that's something that you're very passionate about. And I want to ask you how that kind of how that came about. What was sort of, I guess, the origin of that for you?
So PhD Balance was founded in March of 2018. And it actually was originally founded as PH Depression. This is, and when I say founded, it means an Instagram page was started. So in February of 2018, this really interesting paper came out in Nature Biotech. It was like an opinion piece with some research into it, and found that about 40% of graduate students were dealing with some form of anxiety or depression to like an extent that would cause a doctor to be concerned.
Yeah.
And this was, I read this article and it was really eye-opening to me, and particularly because I happened to be at a conference right around the same time as I was reading the article and thinking about, you know, at the least it's one in four, right? That of graduate students who are dealing with depression or anxiety or other mental illnesses at any given time. And looking around, I was like, yeah, this group of 200 people, though, there's no way that there's 50 who would understand what I had been going through. I've dealt with depression and anxiety and some eating disorders throughout most of my life. And I always felt very like extra embarrassed in grad school for a bunch of different reasons. But basically looking around this group, I thought, okay, maybe it is 25%. Maybe 25% would understand me, but it's not this group of people. Like, that must be the slackers, like me and all the slackers who shouldn't be in grad school. We're not the ones at a conference. And I was like, that doesn't make any sense. Like, I am at this conference and I would absolutely be one of the people who was dealing with depression and anxiety. And this understanding that even as somebody with mental illness who was very aware of it, had been seeing a therapist for a couple of years, I still had this idea of what it would look like to be a graduate student with mental illness. I still had this like very strong stigma about, well, if you have a mental illness, you're not one of these, you know, high reaching. It was actually a ComSciComm conference. So it was a science communication conference. And so everyone there is like dedicated to science communication, like doing a great job with their PhD or their grad work. And so even as someone dealing with it, I still could not believe that this group of very successful, motivated, enthusiastic people were dealing with mental illness. And I was like, that's a problem. And so I started this Instagram page basically to see, okay, could I find other people who are dealing with depression, who are in grad school, that we could share our stories and just kind of commiserate, share tips, be accountability buddies. Put it up, PhD Depression, put up my story and asked other people to share theirs. So it was this contrast between here's the picture of what you see at a conference or, you know, in the hallway, and then here's the story of what's really going on behind the scenes. And it just took off. I ran it by myself for about a month and I was getting a bunch of stories sent to me. Pretty quickly people said, well, I don't have depression, but I have anxiety. I don't have depression, but I have bipolar disorder. I don't have depression, but I've been a victim of a sexual assault.
Yeah.
I want to talk about these things because they've really affected my mental health in grad school. It quickly, we moved over and jumped into Twitter. We kept growing. I say we because it became a whole team of us and it became a business in, I want to say, September of 2018, once we had enough people where basically we became a business, not for money purposes, but just because I own the business. And if there's ever any fallout, that lands on my shoulders and not the people who are working with me.
Yeah.
But now we have a team of, I think, right around 15 people all over the world.
Wow. That's amazing. Were you surprised when the stories started coming in? Is that something that, I know you mentioned that there was, you know, you kind of realized there might be something larger going on here, but when you started getting all these stories initially, when it was just you running it, I mean, did that surprise you?
I guess it didn't surprise me in like immediately. I put in some effort to find the stories at the start, but I figured it would be one of those kind of 2 month experiments, right? Mm. Where you, and I think it's really important that people allow themselves to do those 2 month experiments. The same with Ask Me, I'm a Scientist. That was like, I might do three of these things and then leave them up or take them down. It doesn't matter, but I want to try it. Let's go. And now I've been doing that for a couple of months and I intend to keep going and I've learned a lot, but there's also been a bunch of other 2 month experiments that I've tried where it's like, that's not useful. Like this series isn't useful. Just let it go.
Yeah.
I thought PhD Depression was going to be, let's ask for some stories. Let's maybe get like a 10 stories together, that this nice little page that people can have an idea of, and then all the people who shared stories, like maybe we could all be friends.
Yeah.
Had you told me what this would turn into, there's absolutely no way I would have taken that first step.
Well, I mean, on that note, and I think, you know, before we sort of wrap up the conversation tonight, I did want to ask you to just sort of talk to, you know, people that are going to be listening. We do skew a little younger on the show, which I think is great because people listen to the show and they're, you know, they want to do what you do. You know, they want to sort of follow in your footsteps, but mental health is a really important thing for me. I mean, I've had depression, anxiety, I've suffered from it. My wife has suffered from it. You know, I had double heart surgery, I'm a double heart surgery patient. So like for the first time I had heart surgery, I was, it was really bad for me. The fallout for that was not physically, but just like emotionally. And I just didn't think I was ever going to amount to anything. And, you know, I was writing letters to my son to say goodbye. You know, it was pretty bad. So, I mean, when I heard that you were doing what you're doing, I think that was, it really spoke to me. It spoke volumes to me. And I'd really love for you to just kind of talk about mental health in general. Like how important is it for people to recognize that mental health is very, very important? We see people taking their lives in record numbers. It's a very terrible thing. I feel like it doesn't show any prejudice. It doesn't care. It's a lot like COVID-19, and it doesn't care what race you are, what sex you are. It kills all the same. And so what is it that you want people to know about mental health? What can people take away from this? Where can people go to get help if they need it? Let's talk a little bit about that before we wrap up tonight.
Absolutely. No, thank you for the space to do so, because it's important to me for so many reasons that, you know, I personally have struggled in a bunch of different ways. The moment you start talking about these things, other people start telling you about them, which is really telling that we do feel like we can't talk about it. But like most people, a lot of my mental health issues are also genetic. And so I've dealt with it in my family. You know, to your point of like, it certainly doesn't discriminate about who it latches onto, it doesn't seem. You know, it's like anybody is vulnerable. The difficult part is that our society is built such that some people are less able to get help, whether that's an increased stigma. You know, so for instance, my family, although, you know, no family really, I guess there are some families that like to talk about it. My family has its own issues or whatever, but we at least understood that mental illness is a thing and it's something to take seriously. And so I didn't have to fight that battle on top of everything else. But other folks aren't coming from that kind of climate or that kind of culture. Or similarly, even like for men, it can be especially difficult for men and boys to talk about these things because there's this additional stigma about like, well, what does it say about your masculinity?
Right.
I just want to say that because I think that people, it's a fine line between saying, hey, you know, you shouldn't feel bad about talking about this versus not appreciating that they might be feeling a lot of pressures from other things. So they might have other people in their ear saying, hey, don't talk about it. The truth is that everyone has mental health, right? Like we all have mental health and we will all at some point have mental health issues.
Yeah.
And people don't really think about this, but like, let's say you lose your family dog. Your family dog dies, maybe from old age, maybe from an accident. But either way, it's a very devastating moment. And it's really difficult for you to focus on other things. It's really difficult for you to enjoy, you know, like the things that you'd normally do. Or maybe you'd be walking down the street and you'd suddenly think of this dog that really meant a lot to you. Or maybe you start getting paranoid about other things. You might suddenly be afraid of when your other dog is out for a walk, or you might start not wanting to leave your house because it was when you were gone that this accident happened to your dog, whatever it is. Those are actually mental health issues. The incident that occurred happened then, and it's changed how you think about things. It's changed how you react to your environment. It's changed your emotions. And it's made you a little bit more unstable. It's made it more difficult for you to think logically in the way that you normally would. I think it's really important for people to realize that at some point in your life, you are going to face mental health issues, whether it's from a tragedy or a relationship fallout or, you know, a financial issue, whatever. Yeah. Mental illness is just the next like level of that. if that makes sense. I basically, the way I compare it is like, everyone's going to have breathing problems at some point, right? Like everyone is going to get a cold and it's going to affect how they breathe. It's going to affect their ability to participate in activities that they enjoy. But some people have chronic asthma and some people, no matter what they do, are going to have slight breathing issues, are going to have to be much more aware of things.
Right.
And they just have to know, like for me as someone with mental health issues, I just have to know that the things that are going to cause somebody else a little bit of annoyance or kind of put them down and out for a day, those, if I don't take care of them, can put me out for a week or a month.
Wow. Yeah.
You know, the same as if somebody has asthma and they get a cold, it's not, they can't just shake it off like somebody who is otherwise healthy, doesn't have any underlying health issues.
Yeah.
And so I think the biggest thing is to just know these things about yourself. It's really scary to start asking these questions and think about, is this the way that I want to be living? Can I do a better job of maintaining the life that I want? I feel like as an adult, I don't even remember being a teenager, but you know, if someone asks how you're doing and your first response is like, oh, pretty good. And then you'll say, oh, but I have this headache, or, you know, my back kind of hurts, or I went hiking this weekend and so my legs hurt. We're constantly casually talking about how our physical health is tumultuous or it's changing,
right.
or we'll say it the opposite of, I went for a hike and everything, you know, my legs feel great. I wish we'd do that with mental health. Mm. I wish we would say, oh, I went for a hike and I feel much clearer. I feel like I can think better.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I was stuck inside all weekend, or I slept weird on my bed. Instead of, if you said I was stuck inside all weekend, so I'm pretty restless, people would understand. If you said I'm stuck inside all weekend, and so now I feel really like I can feel my depression kind of kicking in, I wish that was something that we just talked about a lot more. It's so normal. Everyone has mental health. Everyone is going to have mental health issues.
Yeah.
And to understand yourself and understand what your baseline is for dealing with these things.
Very well put. Okay. Well, this has been a deeper conversation, a little bit deeper than most, but I'm a very, very appreciative of that. And I thank you for doing this. And I think before we head out tonight, let's end it on a little bit of a lighter note. I want to end on what has become something of a tradition here on the show. And this is, of course, a very famous questionnaire that was invented by French television host Bernard Pivot. And it was made famous here in the United States by the legendary interviewer James Lipton of Inside the Actor's Studio, who passed away not too long ago. There are 10 questions that I'm going to ask you, and we're going to see, kind of let people get to know you a little bit. So is that okay with you?
Yeah, sounds good.
Okay, so the very first question on the list is, what is your favorite word?
I'm really glad that you told me that we had a younger audience. I really like the word peach.
That is a great word. Mm-hmm. Great word. And peaches taste great too. So I'm with you.
I think that's it. Yeah.
With you on that. What about the opposite? What is your least favorite word?
Ubiquitous.
That's a good one. Okay. Well, moving on. What turns you on?
Wait, how old is our audience? Okay. We're going to go with scientifically.
Yes.
I get really jazzed up about, I really like when somebody challenges a thought that I've had. I like when I get a little bit angry or frustrated, because that means I'm just about to learn something.
That's great. I like that a lot. Okay. What about the opposite? What turns you off?
The word should. That might also be my least favorite word. But when people say, like, you should know something, I'm like, I either need to or want to, or you're abdicating your responsibility to teach me something.
Yeah. Well, you're giving some great, great answers. Okay. Moving on. What sound or noise do you love?
Well, you might get to hear it here in a second here. So my dogs just walked into the room. So that's one of my favorite sounds, is that little dog snuffling.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's what I get to wake up to in the mornings.
I love it. I love it. What about the opposite? What sound or noise do you hate?
Chalk. Like, not even squeaky chalk, just like the sound of, or like unfinished clay moving against unfinished clay. I can't stand the feeling, and just the sound is enough for me to feel that.
Really? Interesting. That's an interesting one. Okay. Well, number 7 is always everybody's very favorite question. What is your favorite curse word?
Can I actually say this?
You sure can.
All right. My favorite curse word, which is actually still my favorite word, is actually just cunt. I think it's an amazing word. It's so short and perfect.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. You could definitely say that. Not a problem. what profession other than yours would you like to attempt?
I love to cook. I would love to be like a food truck cook. I don't really want to have a whole restaurant. That seems like way too much responsibility, but I like the idea of getting really good at like six different things and then being able to drive around and feed people.
God, that'd be great. It'd be like in an alternate life, you have a roach coach. That's what they call them, right? The roach coach. That's pretty cool. I like that. what about the opposite? What profession would you absolutely not like to attempt?
It's funny because I only think about the things that I've actually considered in the past. I'm like, what's the bottom of that one? I mean, from the list of things that I've been like, oh, could I do this? Would definitely be like being a fifth grade teacher or something like that.
Yeah.
Or I think it would really be hard to be a middle school teacher where you have to teach the same topic five times in a day. I taught a lab class for a while and had to teach it twice in the same day. And it was just like, come on, I just explained this to you, but also it wasn't you, so I'm sorry, this isn't your fault.
Right, right. No, that's a very difficult profession. Just teaching in general, but yeah, teaching like grade school of any, my hat's off, definitely. Okay, well, the last question, maybe the most profound. If heaven exists, what would you like to hear God say when you arrive at the pearly gates?
I think I'd want him to say that your friends are here. Like I'd want to know other people there. I'm not religious at all. Like I'm very strongly atheist. But like in this fun little brain chat, I think I would just want to make sure that I had friends wherever I was going next.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a powerful point. Okay. Well, listen, this has been a lot of fun. Do me a favor before we get out of here tonight, plug the website, plug your Twitter. Where can everybody follow you online? Let's do all that jazz.
Yeah. So I highly recommend people follow PhD Balance, because you won't just have me, but you'll have a ton of amazing people talking about mental health. Also just like dealing with stuff in academia, people who aren't in grad school yet. We've got a lot of college students who are going to go to grad school, figuring stuff out. That website is www.phdbalance.com. Similarly, you can go to Twitter or Instagram. Our handles there are PhD_balance. But if you do want to chat with me, see what I'm up to, I sometimes talk about mental health, sometimes science communication. It's a lot of dogs, and also just like random food pictures. So that is, my website is www.susanna, S-U-S-A-N-N-A, the letter L, Harris, H-A-R-R-I-S, .com. Otherwise, it's that same exact super long phrase on Instagram, Twitter, Susanna L. Harris.
This has been an absolute pleasure. I've been waiting for this conversation for a long time, and you didn't disappoint. Thank you so much, Susanna. It's been a real pleasure.
Well, thank you. This has been really fun, and I'm excited to keep checking out your other shows.
If you made it all the way through our conversation tonight, I want to thank you for hanging out with me and my friends. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Please visit us on social media as we post each new conversation as they air. News, show information, and much more. Go to facebook.com/meandmyfriendspod. On Twitter, you can search the handle @meandmyfriendspod. And on Instagram, you can find us by searching the handle @meandmyfriendspod. If you enjoyed our conversation tonight, please do me a favor and head to iTunes to rate us and leave us a review. As a brand new podcast, we need all the help we can get, and your time is truly appreciated. Me and My Friends is produced by Vanessa Williamson and edited by me, Chris Williamson. Tonight, the podcast featured the original track, Fly, by producer Redman. The opinions on Me and My Friends are those of the individual guests and may not reflect those of Chris Evan Films Incorporated. Chris Evan Films Incorporated is not affiliated with the films or clips referred to herein. Any audio clips used in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purposes of education and entertainment, and no infringement is ever intended. Me and My Friends is an exclusive trademark of Chris Evan Films Incorporated and may not be used without the express written consent of Chris Evan Films Incorporated, all rights reserved. Me and My Friends is a Chris Evan Films production, copyright 2020, all rights reserved.